Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast, the weekly podcast where we serve up a hot plate of news for your listening pleasure. I'm your host, Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And today is March the 19th. The weather is getting better, and so is the news. We've seen some positive developments in the banking sector after the failure of two US banks in the past week. Silicon Valley Bank SVB and Signature Bank both collapsed, causing concern among investors that more banks could follow suit. But US regulators stepped in over the weekend to ensure that customers at both banks had full access to the money. The collapse of these two banks had caused a ripple effect in the industry, and shares in San Francisco-based First Republic had sunk nearly 70% over the last week, with fears that it could be the next bank. However, a group of 11 US banks led by JP Morgan and Citigroup came to the rescue with a $30 billion injection into First Republic. This move has boosted stock markets, and shares in First Republic rose more than 20% at one point. It's a positive development for the banking sector, which has been rocked by recent collapses and fears over the health of the system. What do you make of it, Kev? It's been a pretty tumultuous week on the markets, or the early start until it was obviously put under control.
Yeah, I don't think this bank was run very well, to be honest, by what I've read since and understood.
Yeah.
It was not exactly, I think, particularly compliant.
Did you see that quite a few of the directors were ex-laymen?
Yeah. No, I mean, from the looks of what they've actually done, they didn't follow the banking regulations at all. But anyway, that's another story. But I also read or listened to a podcast and commentary on it, and I really liked the analogy. Do you remember, or have you ever watched A Wonderful Life, where he tries to save the...
guy off the bridge.
Yeah, but he tries to save the bank in the first place. Do you remember the co-op, or the savings thing? And the reason why he had to save it was because all the big banks were going to come in and basically, or this other guy was going to come in and take over the town. Well, effectively, if all the smaller banks go in America, then you're just going to be left with no choices. You're only going to have the big banks, and that's what's going to happen. So I'm not sure I'm that keen on the big banks coming in and supporting it, to be honest, but such is life. Anyway, it was a run on the bank. It was as simple as
run on the bank. Yeah, it was removal of deposit. Well, basically, it was withdrawal of cash, wasn't it? Because that's what happened.
Yeah.
We saw it with Northern Rock, didn't we? In the early 2000s, it's exactly the same thing. So, what about the HSBC? The news of HSBC coming in and with the £1 bid for the UK arm of it.
Absolutely cracking deal for HSBC. Unbelievable. You know, they've got an operating bank. I think in the RNS they even said it was worth X million. I don't remember the actual number, but it was, I think, £168 million or something like that. I don't have the number, and Phil maybe try and look for it now while I'm talking, but I think it's a great deal. And also because they're going to be looking after some tech companies that are obviously hopefully going to aspire to do much better. So yeah, it could be.
It was amazing. It was amazing on Monday morning where we saw the RNSs. We were doing the RNS list, and there was literally umpteen number of companies that were running on the, we haven't got any money in SVB. We haven't. We haven't. We're not involved.
It's like, yeah, it's not us.
Washing their hands of them. Moving on to other news, we've had the news, obviously, the long-anticipated Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has unveiled the contents of his first budget in the House of Commons. What do you make of that? I mean, should we have a quick look at a glance, really, what it means? The first one, let's just go through them very quickly. Free childcare to be extended for children over 9 months. Obviously, that saves a lot of families a lot of money going forward when you realise that the UK is one of the most expensive countries for childcare. I think there's something like 30% of a joint income is spent on for childcare in the UK. We've got inflation set to fall to 2.9% by the end of the year. $200 million have been invested to tackle the problem of potholes. Great if you're a motorist. This one is a good one. It's a kind of a bit of a stealth tax, and we talked about this. The freezing of personal thresholds will drag millions into the higher tax bands. Scrapping the allowance and on tax-free pension contributions. This is a good one. I know you're very interested in, you know, you used to work in the pension area. What do you make of this one now, where he's literally removed the cap on the amount that you can invest in terms of tax-free pension?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody thinks it's a fantastic giveaway, and it is in essence, but actually he's done it because of an awful lot of pension money was leaving the United Kingdom. People were moving and investing in qualifying offshore pension schemes, which basically means now the UK government wouldn't get a penny of the taxation applicable on the pension. So now he said, you can have as much as you want. Actually, if you can have as much as you want, then the reality is you're going to take income and you're going to be taxed again on it. So it is a great idea. And I mean, it is brilliant. And
they call it the doctor scheme or something as well here, obviously.
Yeah, he's dressed it up as, you know, we don't want these people leaving the NHS and we don't want, you know, the brain drain at 60 or 65. So he's dressed it up extremely well, but ultimately it's going to make the Chancellor more money in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. Tax on pub pints frozen, but rise on other alcohol duty from August, up to 20 billion of support for carbon capture. This is an interesting one, is this carbon capture, and we'll probably talk about that on another show, but that's interesting that they're starting to invest money into carbon capture and renewable energy as well. And then there's also been a 5p per litre discount on fuel duty extended for another year. So yeah, I think in the grand scheme of things, it's you know, for the common man, there's not a lot of savings there, is there really? But people are going to end up paying more taxes in the long run.
Well, the other thing, coming just back quickly to the pensions, is the amount that you can actually put into your pension now, which is £60,000 a year. And actually, you can backdate that 4 years. So people with an amount of money, you know, they've made a good amount of money on a deal or on selling their business or whatever, they can actually put in, you know, close to £250,000 in their pension now to make it up if they want to. So, you know, there is some good things there for people who've got money and have made money in terms of that. For the man on the street, it's as is, really. I don't think much has changed, other than inflation has eaten the value of what you actually have. And it's going to continue to, because, you know, all those things are stuck till 2028. So, you know, we've got another 4 years of basically the same amount. Taxation is going to be increasing effectively as wages go up. Yeah. But we've borrowed a huge amount of money. Obviously,
we've had it easy for a long time. Borrowing has been cheap, hasn't it? Now it's time that, unfortunately, you can't go through a pandemic where they've spent £400 billion on keeping the lights on in businesses and at homes. And that's the reality, you know. Future generations are going to be paying it back.
Yeah, even the corporation tax has gone up significantly now, gone up to 25%. So, again, it's sort of giving it with one hand, taking it with the other. So it's a case of deciding what way you're going to do it.
So in other news this week, and this was one that made national headlines, was the first UK medical cannabis group to win the rights to sell in Britain, and the update to the Home Office licence will also allow the London-listed pharmaceuticals group to pursue supply deals. What do you make of that news, Kev?
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. It's an area where we obviously need the relaxation of these things, and to use cannabis for what it's been used for centuries, I think. So yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Well, why don't we ask someone who actually knows this thing? I mean, today we're joined by James Short, Chief Executive Officer of Celadon Pharmaceuticals, a UK-based pharmaceutical company focused on cannabis-based medicines. Welcome, James. I'll call you Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. Hi, Phil, and hi, Ken.
So do you want to start? So let's start from the beginning. Tell us a bit about yourself and what got you into the cannabis space in the first place.
Yeah, so I'll give you the short version, actually. So my background is, you know, 30-odd years ago, building businesses, predominantly property. I had a business doing nursing homes, and I went into the psychiatric care. I subsequently sold that business. And then in 2020, I went into the renewable space, built a successful energy from waste company, and we exited that in 2010. I sort of had a rest. I started investing in other businesses, predominantly IT, etc. Well, actually, it was beginning of 2018, and my son approached me and a business partner of his, Paul, and said, "I've asked me, am I interested in investing in the cannabis space?" And I said categorically no. And that's typically from, because of my age and my NIMBYism, because I've only ever been brought up that cannabis is illegal, it's bad for you, etc., etc. So I said no. And then my son, you know, persistent as he is, he came back to me and said, "Look, Dad, it's actually the CBD world we want you to look at." So I had a look at it, and I still said no again, because I didn't feel that the CBD world was for me. It wasn't regulated enough for me. It was more of a branding thing, and I'm not a branding kind of as investor. So I left it alone. And then towards the end of 2018, the UK government legalized cannabis for medicinal use only. And a lot of people actually in the UK are not aware that cannabis is legal for medical use only. So this isn't your CBD stuff. This isn't your recreation stuff. It is medical. And it's a completely different world when you talk about medical cannabis. So he came back to me and said, you know, the government have legalized it. So I said, okay, let me have a deeper look at this. So I did the usual. I went off to Canada, looked at operations there, did a little bit of looking in the US. We met people in Israel and who were doing some amazing stuff in Israel. And what I also did, Phil, I met an awful lot of patients in the UK that were taking medical cannabis, albeit illegal, for certain diseases such as chronic pain, epilepsy, MS. And I met a number of them, and one particular guy really changed me, and a lady as well. And this guy was shaking. I actually felt scared because he was shaking that much. And his wife managed to get some cannabis into him, and then I could see him calm down.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is unbelievable. How odd can this be? You know, it's a plant. And it was actually then when the light bulb went on to me and thought, you know what? If I can produce a product, cost-effective, in the UK that can help these people, fantastic. So that was the light bulb moment for me. And then the other advantage we had, I took control of a building in 2017, which is our current headquarters. And as I took the building, just short of 30 million had been spent on the facility from a secure, because it was a co-location data center. So I thought, well, you know, I've got this building, this product works, it can't be armored. So we set off on the journey beginning of 2019. And I've got to say, it's been a heck of a journey. It's been very difficult. A, because we're dealing with two main regulators, the Home Office and the MHRA. So MHRA deal with anything pharmaceutical and other things, and the Home Office deal with narcotics and firearms. So we've got two regulators here that I had to work with, and it's new to the country. So we're the first company since legalization to get the licenses that we now have. And what I also spotted, Phil, was globally, there weren't a lot of corporate governance around these companies. Now, I'm used to corporate governance. You know, my past businesses that I've built and sold, you've got to put a lot of corporate governance around. And I thought, right, well, if I fetch my business head into it, corporate governance head into it, you know, let's go for it. And that's what, you know, fast forward to today, 4 years on, we've raised 20 plus million. We've got a number of patients on a trial that we own as well. So that's how I got into it, really.
Fascinating story, to be honest.
Yeah,
from a background that, you know, as you say, that in a completely different industry there, that you know it's amazing that you've moved into it, and then obviously been awarded with you know, the upgrade to the licenses. So let's look at the, you know, what you were formerly known as and what made you go on to the market. You know, you were obviously a private company at that point, and you were formerly known as, I believe it was Summerway Capital.
Yeah, so Summerway was a shell that we ended up reversing into.
Yeah,
and we did that because it had capital, and we just thought it would be, hindsight's a wonderful thing. We thought it'd be a little bit faster, but actually it wasn't, because AIM have been so supportive of us and, you know, the cannabis space, but from a regulatory point of view, the barrier is so high. There's only two companies ever got on AIM in this space. GW Pharma, which is a fantastic British success story, was on AIM. They then dual listed on NASDAQ, and they recently sold that business for $7.5 billion last year. So, you know, it was very difficult. So we've always been Celadon. We reversed into Summerway. It gives us access to capital. I'd like to say it got us on the market faster. It actually didn't. It took a long time because the regulators were nervous, quite rightly. We believe they turned a number of companies down last year that tried to do it. And I think the reason why we managed to get on the market is, and I say this to all investors and everybody, Celadon is a pharmaceutical company that uses a cannabinoid as its core ingredient. We are not a cannabis company. We are a pharma company. So we're coming at it from a pharma regulation, not a cannabis company. That is very fundamental. And in answer to your question, why did we list when we did, I just felt that we needed as a company to stand out above all the rest of the guys that are in the market that are doing, you know, CDD and things like that. Not that that's wrong. It's just that every time I spoke to investors, it were, oh, you're just another CBD company. And I kept saying, well, we're not. We're a pharma company. And what it also allowed us to do, Phil, well, this was prior to the Ukraine war, it allowed us to access capital because there is a pent-up demand of corporate capital that wants to come into this space. It just can't unless you've got the right corporate governance. And by listing, it has allowed us to attract some institutional investors, albeit the small, not the large. We've had some of the large guys, you know, come and visit us, speak to us, but we weren't raising enough money for them. And, you know, but we still, you know, we're still engaged with the larger, you know, your Fidelities of this world.
Sure. So here you were. So as you've mentioned, it was a kind of a cash shell. It was the usual RTO or whatever, you know, yeah, that sort of thing. You raised £8.5 million in a placing and subscription, I think, to obviously institutional and other investors around 165 pence a share or something around that mark.
Yeah, we actually raised 20 in total.
Okay, in total, yeah.
Yeah.
So with those funds, am I right in thinking that there was an acquisition of Vertigro, which was one of the first pharma companies in the UK to receive that license to grow the
yeah, no. No, so interestingly, Vertigro was our company. It's just when I founded Celadon, we put a company above called Vertigro. Okay. And that was to allow us to help us get the home office license, right, because we didn't want the outside world thinking we're doing cannabis in the early days. And that was literally from a compliance point of view. So we still own Vertigro, still within our chain. In fact, I think our accounts have recently just changed the name of Vertigro to Celadon. So we actually already owned that in theory in the group.
Yeah. So tell us about the facility and what sort of, you know, revenue that could be generated within this facility.
Yeah. So our current facility, and we are, you know, we're in talks with a number of other potential facilities as well. And you'll see why in a minute, because of the potential scale of the opportunity. So our current facility is 100,000 square foot, which is round about the size of 3 football pitches, just to put it in context. So it's a very large facility. Highly secure, it's got lots of power, lots of resilience, etc. As I said, when we took it over, there was 30 million spent on it, and we've since spent several millions after. If our facility was fully operational tomorrow, which hopefully we'll have it fully operational by the end of next year, but if it was fully operational tomorrow, we could only produce enough product for 50,000 patients. And that's around about 90 to 100 million of revenue, of which around 50-52 EBITDA. So you can see the potential scale, but I'll just give another number out there. We currently are focused on chronic pain. There's around 20 odd million people with pain in the UK, of which 8 million have chronic pain. The government have given a list. This government, I think they did in conjunction with King's College. They've come up with a list of around 3 million people that are eligible for a cannabinoid that have chronic pain. So think of the numbers that I've said. We can only produce enough product for 50,000 patients. That's 100 million revenue. The government have given us a list of 3 million people. That's even if we'd have got 2% of that, we need 4 or 5 more buildings. That is the scale of this opportunity. And when I saw that, I went, this is just incredible.
So that was actually going to be my question, Jim, in terms of the size of this. Obviously, 90 million turnover actually just scratches the surface, and 50,000 patients scratches the surface of the UK opportunity. And there are obviously huge barriers to entry. I mean, can you explain to us a little bit about the barriers to entry that, and you know, people coming into the UK market in this situation?
Yeah, so there's two options. You know, somebody wants to come into the UK, they either do what we've done and build a facility, invest all the capital, get all the approvals and operate in the UK. In the short term, that's quite hard. You know, it took us 4 years. Somebody else, it'll probably take them 3 years and it'll cost them 50 to 60 million to get to where we are. So the question is, well, why should I go and do that? Why should I not just import it from our operation in Canada or wherever? The challenge is it's not easy to import this product into the UK. You can only import it on what's called a named patient basis. So in other words, you have to have a patient, you have to have a prescription, you've got to get it stamped, And then you can fetch that product in for that one patient for that month. They've just extended that to 3 months after your first month. So it's not as if, Kevin, you can fetch tons of this product into the country. And that's not just England, that's across the world, because we've spent 80 plus years stopping the movement of narcotics. They're not all of a sudden going to say, oh yeah, fetch tons of this into the country. It's just not going to happen. That is a parliamentary change for that to ever happen. So this is where it gives us a bit of a moat, whereby we produce in England, we can now, under our license, produce it and distribute that product within 24 hours of it being released at a much, much cheaper cost than what it's costing to import the product, because there's lots of middlemen in the middle taking their cuts.
So from that perspective, then, if one of the ambitions of Celadon is to take the pain away from all of these people who are suffering from, severe pain or acute pain, and the cannabinoid is going to do that, how on earth are we going to get Celadon and others to the point where you can provide enough for 3 million patients?
It's honestly, Kevin, that is a fantastic question. And I'm not, and this is one of the questions that one of the debates we constantly have when we sit down with government, with NICE or with the regulators for the NHS. Because it's okay saying the NHS will reimburse, that's one thing. But the other thing is, if we reimburse, how are we going to get the product? And that's why I always say that while Celadon's got on board, fantastic, Celadon welcomes other businesses to do what Celadon's done in England, because of the scale of the opportunity is incredible. What we are currently doing within Celadon is looking at partnering in the UK, and we've had a number of discussions with companies that want to diversify from what they're currently growing to grow plants under license by us. That will help us scale up. So for instance, GW Pharma, they use British Sugar to grow for them under license because they saw the potential issue. And bear in mind, GW Pharma's only got, I think it's a few hundred patients globally. That's a $7.5 billion business. They've just been acquired for $7.5 billion. They've got a few hundred patients. So you can see this scale of the opportunity. And all we can do, Kevin, is try and keep ahead of the curve and keep trying to get more sites. The challenge is going to be, is the investor community open to that? You know, it's a bit like an Amazon model or a Tesla model. You know, you've got to go and build and get ready and be confident that the market will take your product. And that's what we're proving over this last year and this year and the next year, that the market is ready for our product.
Yeah, so if we were to turn around and ask you, how many patients do you think Celadon can supply this to by, let's say, 2027, 4 years from now, and then maybe 2030? What are your hopes and expectations in terms of that?
So actually, I think we can be in the hundreds of thousands, maybe million. And the reason why I'm confident with that, Kevin, is we have, over the past 4 years, we have perfected our operations of growing. So when I say growing, we grow in a very, very indoors, hydroponic, very tight control. We've developed software, we've developed IT. You know, we don't just switch a light on in our room. We mimic the sunrise, the sunfall, the wind, the CO2. And we've been perfecting this all right over the past, as I say, 4 years. So we believe now, we're not 100% there. You know, we're going to learn quite a lot from our phase two, but we believe that we're at a point where actually we can flip sites on a lot faster. The one of the sites that we're looking at now, we'll be able to supply over 200,000 patients from it. You know, and you've got to have a couple of these projects going at the same time, and that's what we're doing. It's about scale up. And as Bill said before, you know, it's interesting where you come from, my background to where I am. And actually, when you look at it, Celadon's trajectory is going to be, how fast can we build these buildings? And I've got a bit of experience in that because I've had 20-odd years.
Yeah, cool.
You know, and the next challenge is energy. Well, I did 10 years in that. So there's a lot of skill set gone in that I've developed over 30 years that we're now implementing within Celadon. So in answer to your question, Kevin, I would like to think we could get to the hundreds of thousands and ideally a million or more. But we've got to learn how to run a marathon first, and we're doing that.
But I think, I suppose I'm just putting the expectation out there that the 90 million that you've been able to say in RNS is really just the beginning.
Oh, yes. It's, yeah. Well, I'll give you another stat. So we own 20% or 90% of an autism trial. This is a full clinical trial. Now, it's probably going to take another 3 to 4 years or 5 years, you know, to find out whether that trial's successful. The results we've had are very good. There's hundreds of years of data there. Unfortunately, not quite for autism, but we can see the signs. If that trial's successful, and we're going for minors in a certain category with autism, which is very close to my own because my one of my nephews, he's got autism, and I've seen him grow up. If we are successful with that trial, we will need 17 of our current facilities for 4% of the market. It's amazing. I've never had a business where the opportunity potentially is so great. I really have.
Yeah. I was going to ask you a question about it, because obviously you mentioned, it sounds fascinating that you've got, you know, as you say, you're mimicking sunrise, sunset and wind, and, you know, as if it's growing in a natural environment, as if they grow it in New Mexico or somewhere like that, where I know a lot of the US, you know, cultivators grow it. But is it possible that you can, that you can grow or new strains of cannabis with specific concentrations of THC to target specific medical conditions? Is that something that happens?
Yeah, and that we actually have a program in-house that we're doing. So we own some of our own genetics now. It's called Phenohunting.
Yeah.
So we have a lab here on site that we spent millions of pounds on. Whilst we've been waiting for these licenses, I've had to keep our staff engaged. So we started a program to start that Phenohunting. You know, we're seeing some incredible signs. And what it's about, Phil, it's about identifying that molecule and using technology, i.e. AI, to speed that process up to understand, actually, if you use that molecule, you put something else with it, it really helps with that disease. So one that we are looking at the minute and we're super excited about is THCV. So it's part of the cannabinoid plant, but it's a THC. And the results, not just from us, from history, the results for reducing diabetes are just off the scale. And in the opposite to that as well is you're helping the diabetes, but you're actually helping with weight loss. And if you tweak it a bit, you can actually get weight gain for anorexia. So it's just fascinating. And for me, we're not just sitting still and saying, yeah, it's chronic pain and it's what are we? What have we not seen yet? And that's where the real IP value starts coming into it. But you've got to balance it. You know, I don't want to just be an R&D company and sinking loads of money. I'm old school. I want money. I want revenue, and I want profit.
Sure.
And on the back of that, you know, it will then escalate that R&D. And luckily at the moment, the government is still behind, albeit they've changed it, R&D and things like that.
And I guess you can tweak the levels of CBD in it as well, some strains, so that you've not got the psychoactive. Because the last thing you want is people, but you know the walking stoned almost. You know what I mean? It's like, is it possible to administer the drug without patients getting kind of high off it?
It is actually THCV. It's less potent and things like that, and that's what we're working on.
Yeah, and how would your average patient take it? I mean, is it vaporizer type?
So our current LVL trial, so we own 57% of the LVL Health Clinic. That is the only UK government approved trial, albeit they put some conditions and we're just satisfying those. But we've got just short of 100 patients that have been on that for many, many months. And that particular trial, it is a vaporizer. We've developed an app that talks to it. So he can only be given at certain times, certain doses, certain temperature. The doctor, it's all telemedicine. The doctor can, you know, look at the administrating. If there's, we've actually got a pattern now, you know, first 3 days with the patient, it peaks and then it levels out. But for instance, that trial we got, so The Guardian did a piece on one of our patients at the middle of last year. And, you know, this particular young lady, and we've got stuff on her in our facility. This particular young lady worked for one of the water companies. She had to pack a job up because she was in pain. She was on all these opioids, and I think it was 30-odd a day, something like that. She's been on our trial. I think she's been on 9 or 10 months now. But after 3 months, she'd gone from 30-odd tablets to 3 tablets a day, and she's now back to work.
Wow.
And I spoke to her. You know, The Guardian interviewed her, and she said, look, there's anything I could do. She said, I've got my life back. Mm. How do you put a value on that? The quality of that. And there's So when, you know, when I set the company up, you know, we've had some real bumpy rides and very stressful. The first 2 years, you know, you hear about Elon Musk sleeping in the office and that. I genuinely slept in the office. Yeah. It was that stressful. It was.
And the passion's coming through. And as you say, it must be great to feel to be involved in something that is genuinely life-changing for many, many people. As you say, you know, my mother's got Parkinson's and I've seen some of the videos of when they, you know, they're shaking 1 minute and then they take some, you know, THC or medical cannabis, and the next minute they're just so calm and it's like this switch going off.
It is, and it's all about, Phil, not putting your mum in a position where she has to go and buy it off the black market, because that's illegal.
Yeah.
Secondly, she doesn't actually know what she's buying. And it's about getting the doctor comfortable of being able to prescribe your mum. And because this is an approved trial, the doctors are a lot more comfortable in prescribing. And it's about measured dose and it's about quality. But it does, genuinely, if I've got a down day, I'll get one of our nurses to speak to some of the patients, give me a list, and I'll ring them up. And I've ring lots of them. You know, I've had some great stories. You know, one old boy, I've not been able to get in the bath for years. It's changed my life. Another old boy, I've never put as many mileage on my car because he was housebound. Just things like that. And like, this is, so whilst it's a chronic pain trial, the results we're seeing are they're getting a good night's sleep because they take a different dose at night. So, well, if anybody can get a good night's sleep, the quality of life increases because they feel better. And so they're getting a good sleep. The pain's reducing. Some patients, it's not going 100% because if they need a nip replacement, they kind of already
isn't going to fix that, is it?
Exactly. So it's reduced that. But
sure.
More importantly, and we knew this would happen, but we needed evidence and we're now building that. We're actually working with York University at the moment. They're compiling all the data that we've collected and they're going to put it in a report for us. But the real game changer that we're seeing is the fact that they're coming off all these other tablets. You know, we've got ex-rugby guys that were on 60-odd tablets a day. One guy, I can't mention his name, he was quite firm, he said, I was rattling and rattling because he were having so many tablets. You know, and he's been like, he's just, because big lads, they don't want to admit that they're in all this carry on. And the results have just been there. And it's, you know, and that's what makes me happy. And go back to what I said at the beginning. I met patients. I saw it work. It makes me happy. Now, I've just got to build a business. And don't get me wrong, we have to be commercial. We have to make money. But my job's quite easy now because I have a product that I know works for patients. I've just got to get it to them. So our philosophy is patient first, the disease that they've got. Then it's what is the best delivery mechanism for that patient? And then it's education around doctors. The rest of it's just business. It's building more facilities, getting more product, getting more revenue. That's, I'd like to say it's easy, but that's, you know, that's been done day in, day out. That's just building businesses.
Yeah. And then as we talked briefly earlier on, I think that, you know, never underestimate how much work has gone into getting this GMP, this good manufacturing practice approval that was announced this week. I mean, do you want to just tell the listeners just how much work, blood, sweat?
Yeah, so the one this week is actually the home office. That's the narcotic bit. So we've had an home office license for 2 years because we had to grow the product and extract. And so we've had 7 harvests already. We have to do that to demonstrate to the MHRA, who are the regulator for GMP, that we can do what we've said 3 consistent times. We did it 7, but you have to do it minimum of 3. So GMP stands for Good Manufacturing Practice. It doesn't sound that hard, 3 letters. I thought that sounds easy. Any pharmaceutical company has to operate under GMP.
As easy as ABC.
That's what I thought. Trust me, that's not anybody. And I went, oh, let's have a go at that. Flipping it, 4 years down the line and several millions in and lots of sleepless nights. It's been the hardest lift I have ever done in my career getting GMP. Honestly, it is. Not just because it's pharmaceutical and I understand it because it's going into the patient's body and it's, but actually because it's a cannabinoid as well. And it's pretty much new to the country. So when you're working with regulators, whilst they've got something in black and white, it doesn't always fit in black and white. And it's been really difficult. So we actually got our GMP in January. We did an RNS in January, but the market didn't fully understand that. They thought it was the home office that were the big deal. And it is, they're both And then last week, as of this week, I forget time, we did an RNS that we got our own office renewed, which now allows us to produce the product for the first time in 4 years and sell it.
Yeah.
So we've been producing product, we have an inventory, but we've not been allowed to sell it. Now we can sell our product into the market. And since we announced in January, we've had so many inquiries, and I knew it would happen. You know, we've been talking to businesses for the last 2 years or so that have wanted our product, but I couldn't have meaningful conversations with them because I didn't know whether I was going to get a license to be able to sell the product. But we've kept in touch with them. Since we got it in January, we've had an influx, and an influx of new potential customers. You know, we've got a number of LOIs flying around at the minute. We've actually took a sales guy on in January, Stuart. He's come from Farmer. He's been in the cannabis space in the UK for 6-7 years since legalization. So we've had to take him on now to deal with the potential income in inbound inquiries. So in answer to your question, Phil, the GMP has been pretty damn difficult, but we got it. We're there.
Sounds like it, Jim. And obviously, this is a negative because you've gone through all that process and that process has cost you a significant amount of money, and a positive now because everyone coming behind you has to do the same thing, maybe a little bit quicker, but not a great deal.
And again, good comment. I gave you a lot of compliments here, Kevin, but actually, when the regulators came to side, the Home Office and the MHRA, they said, this is the standard. This is the standard they want to see. And actually, the MHRA, the inspector, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, he came out to sign. Bear in mind, we'd gone through COVID, so we couldn't come to site then. He had been once before. So he came to site on an inspection the back end of last year. And when he walked round, this is a three-day audit. And on the second day, he went, my anxiety levels are down here now. Because he was so confident. I'll invite you guys on.
He didn't accidentally swallow a couple of pills or something while he was there, did he?
No, well, they're not allowed to. That's the thing. And I was just going to say, you know, you're invited to come to site. But
yeah, I would love to.
I can't give you any goodie bags, unfortunately, because it's illegal, even though we've got a license.
Even if I come with a prescription, say I've got a sore back.
We can't actually, Kevin, that. Again, we can't actually give you any product, even if you've got a prescription. Because we're not allowed to sell it direct to the patients. We have to go through the private clinics or pharmacies and things like that.
Okay, what I'm going to ask you now is more the financial side of things. This seems like not a limitless, but certainly something that can be expanded drastically. So what sort of is the cash position of the business, and what will be the situation in terms of the requirement of cash so that you can expand this quickly and make everybody a lot more money?
Yeah, so cash currently, you know, as you know, AIM rules, business rules, you've got to have enough cash on balance sheet for 12 months. We've got that. We could extend that out further if we slowed down our build out on phase two. We don't really want to do that because of all the potential orders that of interest that we're getting in. So, you know, we've enough cash on balance sheet to go as we are. We raise enough cash at the market. In answer to your second question for other facilities, originally, Kevin, what I said to the business was, let's get to revenue, let's get that money in, and let's use that cash to further expand. And that at the moment is still where we want to be looking. However, we have had some very interesting conversations with different funds that would like to help us accelerate our program. So such as landlords, look, we'll put the money up to do the fit out and we'll charge you a higher rent. You know, conversations like that will potentially speed up our rollout of our plants. And I hope that answers your question, Kevin. So with cash on balance sheet, we can eke it out further than 12 months. But we don't want to. We want to keep a foot to the gas to get phase two online so we can get to that big of revenue. You know, phase one, that's operational. We've got enough there now. We'll have products September, October that we can start selling in the market on phase one. But that doesn't get us cash positive, phase one. It gets us revenue, but not cash positive. Phase two will get us cash positive. And that's what we raised the money for when we listed on the market.
Okay, that's good. I mean, that's why you list on a market, isn't it? So you can raise funds. So
So
a lot of investors do think, oh, no, it's a raise, it's a raise, it's a raise. But actually, when companies raise, unless it's just to keep the lights on, which actually quite obviously isn't the case in this situation now that you've got the license, then it's going to be to expansion, to hasten the pace to cash flow positive, then profit, and then just the scalability of the whole business.
That's it. That's it. And I've actually had, you know, lots of those conversations with our current institutional investors, and, you know, obviously they've seen the share price, but we have a great set of investors, and you know, a lot of companies can say that, I don't think, in this current climate, but we have, because they've got my vision. Don't get me wrong, you know, we were on at 165 and people said, why did it drop? And part of that was because of the summer where reversed. There was a bunch of people in there that I couldn't pitch to, and they actually invested in some way as a tech investment, so they cashed out when they could. And the other reason why it dropped off was because the whole markets went. So I have had conversations with our current investors, and they're really supportive, and they've given the same sentiments as what you just said, Kevin. It's, look, if you need more money, you obviously need it because you're expanded. And I relate it to a tax bill. You know, a lot of people don't like paying a tax bill, but you must have done something good to be paying a tax bill. So pay the bloody thing, you know, and it's the same with us. And there's lots of instruments we can be looking at. You know, is it a bond? Is it debt? Is it this? Is it, you know, there's those kind of things. But I've got to say, where we are positioned in Birmingham, and fortunately Birmingham have just been granted, what is it, X billions or hundreds of millions or whatever it is, Birmingham have been very, very helpful. So there's access to cash that we can potentially draw on to help us expand, because they want us to stay within.
Is that the whole levelling up type yes. scenario? Yeah.
Yeah, it couldn't have come at a better time for us. And we have got a couple of sites we're looking at. Birmingham City have fetched to us through Andy Street's, you know, office.
Yeah.
And they've been brilliant. Honestly, they've you know, people said, why did you pick Birmingham? Well, it's because I had the facility, but I've got to say, access to talent has been brilliant. You know, it's the largest hospital we've got in England, the QE. You know, the nurses, the doctor, it's just, they've been so supportive.
Very good. All right. Well, we're on the subject. Obviously, you're on the Sunday Roast podcast, and, you know, it's a question we have to ask our guests. What is your favourite Sunday Roast, or what is your perfect Sunday Roast?
It actually is, well, slightly greedy. I actually, if I go out, I ask for the two meats. Because my dad was a butcher, and, you know, no good me trying to be a vegetarian when my father was a butcher.
What, lamb and beef?
Lamb and beef.
Good combination.
Love it. But actually, having said that, I do like turkey when it's available. I know a lot of people don't. So I do like the Sunday roast, and I actually like cooking them. I'm not a great cook, but it's a way for me to switch off. I've got a bit of a routine on it. Not every Sunday, but...
Yeah, it's nice.
I like to get up.
A lot of people complain about it, but it's quite nice to just switch off from it all, isn't it? And just immerse yourself in the kitchen and cook some nice...
Oh, it really does. Lisa, my wife, she just knows when I'm ready and I'm on it. I take the dogs out early, 5, 6 o'clock. I'll have me... She said, well, he's lying on a Sunday, but I can't. And it's another day to me. And then I do a couple of hours work just to get ready for Monday. And then I'm in the zone, you know, music goes on, couple of beers, and I'm cooking. And they actually call me Jimmy Oliver at home. You know, I get in because I'm not an amazing cook, but I'm very organized and I've got it all set. And then we eat around 2, 3 o'clock, bottle of wine, I'm in bed by 9 o'clock. That's me, pretty boring. But I do like my Sunday roast.
So are you growing a few... hydroponic herbs and lettuces and things like this, or
no, and it's a true story. When we started, so 2019-20, when we had phase one sort of finished, I said, look, why don't we start growing chilies to keep the guys busy? And our chief scientist officer and our head of operations said, not a chance. You are not letting a foreign product into our facility, because it can pick up pathogens and things like that.
Yeah.
And that, again, that, you know,
you could have more than heat in the chili then.
You could. I'll tell you what, we'd have super chilies with the environment we operate in. And strangely, somebody bought me a box for Christmas with chilies to grow my own chilies and some other plant. I'm not very good at growing things, trust me. I've not got great fingers.
Well, on that note, we'll say James Short, CEO of Celadon Pharmaceuticals. Thanks very much for your time.
No, thank you, Phil. Thanks, Kevin, as well. And as I say, you're more than welcome to come and visit us. But what I wouldn't advise is you just turn up because you won't get let in. It's highly secure. But I'd love to get in and have a look around. And
say, sure, we'll take you up on that. Be fascinating. Thanks very much.
Yeah. And I would highly recommend as well, if this is of any interest, I would highly recommend that you try and speak to, you know, people that have been on medical cannabis legally. I would highly recommend it. It will open your mind.
Sure. So on to our second guest this week. Aterion PLC holds a diversified portfolio of critical and strategic metals projects in Africa and is focused on expanding its asset base while prioritizing ethical and sustainable supply chains. The metals supplied by the company are crucial for the growth of renewable energy, automotive and electronic manufacturing sectors, which are essential in achieving global climate ambitions and reducing carbon emissions. Presently, the company has three joint ventures in Rwanda, where it's exploring and developing small-scale mining operations for tantalum, niobium, tin. Additionally, Aterion recently acquired Aterion Resources Limited, a wholly owned subsidiary of Elemental Altus Royalties Corp, with a specific focus on battery metals. Aterion owns a portfolio of 15 copper, silver, and base metal projects spanning the project area of 762 square kilometers in the Kingdom of Morocco. Aterion's primary objective is to identify and pursue new opportunities for exploration, production, and trading of critical and strategic minerals across the African continent. We welcome Charles Bray, Executive Chairman of Aterion. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Welcome, Charles. Good to see you on Zoom after we met you down in Undaba in beautiful Cape Town, South Africa. So it's great to see you. We saw you on the stall that you had in the Undaba, where I think there was lots of interest in your company. Is that right?
That's right. There was. That Explorer Showcase, I think, was a very good feature of the Undaba conference, and we really enjoyed it. We had a lot of traffic through our stand, and we're working hard to change some of that traffic into some deal flow and progress these assets.
Very good. Now, today we were going to have yourself and Simon Rawlinson, who's
yes.
the CEO, I believe. Simon was unable to make it today, so we're going to feature just part of Aterion today. And that part that we thought we'd focus on, because I think it makes you stand out from the crowd in terms of resource sector plays, is the ability there to trade in the metals. You know, we look at some of the biggest businesses on the planet in resources, things like Glencore, who have made more money from trading than anything else. So would you like to tell us just a little bit about how Aterion's going to take over the African market in terms of trading, or especially Rwanda, I think, is what you had
said. Yeah, let's start there. We applied, when we acquired East Inco Limited, which is our Rwandan subsidiary, probably over 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago, we applied for a trading license. And my background, by way, is capital markets, investment banking. More specifically, I started off as a trader. And so I started off with commodity, FX, and equities trading with Credit Suisse and BNP Paribas. And as part of that training, I learned how to trade. And so, and the first rule that I learned was understand your underlying markets. So we spent the past 2.5-3 years really studying the market, understanding how the tantalum market, tin market, and tungsten market in Rwanda work, spending quite a bit of money getting to establish what's called a comptoir, or a center where people can come with various degrees, or I should say various grades of ore, and then working to understand how to upgrade that to make it so that it's a specification that can trade on international markets. Tantalum is a very, call it niche market, but it offers very high margins and it offers a lot of opportunity. So we're working really hard to become one of those individuals who market traders can go to and sell their product, get paid relatively quickly, and have an assurance that we'll be there the next day to work with them, to trade with them. And given it's an artisanal marketplace, those features are valuable. They're appreciated and they're welcome. Then that's not to besmirch any of the existing traders in the market. There are some good ones and there's some ones who we consider could do better. but we really want to be at the top of that list. With
it's
the
a very political, politically correct way of saying that
there's some crap trick.
You are of American descent, I think.
Yes.
So you sugarcoat it. Okay, so there's some crap ones and there's some okay ones.
Yeah, there's some good ones. We want to be one of the better ones trading
teams. You want to be one of the better ones.
Yeah.
Okay, so has that trading begun or are you still watching what's going on?
No, what has... Okay, in order to trade properly in Rwanda, you need to have a few things. One is you need to be able to demonstrate to both the mining board there as well as to the outside world that you have traceability and you can provide traceability on your products. So we've spent the last year applying for a membership to the International Tin Supply Chain Initiative. It's called ITSCI. And as part of that, we participate or are a member in their due diligence process. So we've hired a due diligence officer, and what she's going to be doing is focusing on basically KYC, all the stuff that you typically have to do whenever you start a bank account or open some sort of financial account in the UK. Very similar sort of process, but on an industrial type scale. And we've built out a compound. We're nearing the completion of that construction. We've purchased some product, relatively small, that we've effectively warehoused for the time being. And we've begun discussions with providers or let's say off-takers. So what we're hoping to announce over the next 2 months, 3 months potentially, is who those off-takers are, who we're going to be selling product to. And as well, we'll have a database or custom CRM type system that allows us to contact the people who we'll be buying from in country as well. So we're not there just yet, but we should be rolling full steam, I'd say, from May 1.
Okay, that sounds very exciting. I mean, what sort of margins can you hope to attain on this stuff? I mean, I presume you're buying the ore and then maybe do you have the opportunity to upgrade the ore or mix the ore so that...
Yeah, so that's that it exactly. So when you look at Rwanda as a country with its mining background, and it has years and years of mining history, but what they don't have are what I describe as large industrial type mining companies. We're hoping to change that over the near future in terms of partnering with some and bringing them into the country. But for now, what you do have is thousands and thousands of artisanal miners. And these guys can go out and they can mine with picks and shovels and produce, let's say, 100, 200, 300 kilos of ore. We're looking to then purchase that ore because it might not be to the specification that's required. Upgrade the ore. And when you buy ore, to get back to your point on margins, when you buy ore, let's say 10% grade for Ta205, which is the tantalum oxide, you can achieve a certain discount because it's not, let's say, 25 to 30%, which is generally the accepted grade that's traded in the market. With that discount, we then can wash it, we can improve it, get it up to the necessary grade, and we get to keep that margin. So margins generally, if you're buying 25 to 30% grade, gross margins are anywhere from, let's say, 7 to 15% on occasion, depending if it's a rising market or declining market, you can have 5%, you can have 20%. But that's kind of the range, gross margins. And then we're expecting net margins to be about half of that.
Okay. And that is the margin with you upgrading it, or you're likely to get the benefit from upgrading?
No, there's what I would describe as there's an additional benefit if you upgrade it.
Okay. And what type of margin can you expect from that?
There you can expect an additional, let's say, 5 to 10% of gross margin. Again, if you're talking 10% grade coming in, probably closer to 10% additional margin. Once you get to kind of 15, 20, the margin drops as what's required in terms of upgrading it. Less is required.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So in this compound that you have, you're going to have equipment that will wash the stuff, wash the ore and process. Okay. So it's quite an undertaking on your behalf to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some technical work and we have the right people involved. We recently hired Luke Rogers, who was the COO for Trinity. Which ran one of the most profitable and largest tungsten mines in the country. He's running the trading operation effectively, and he's been integral to a lot of the work we've been doing and the improvements we've made. So right now, we're just testing.
Sounds good.
And after you've tested, what type of volume do you expect that you can do? I mean, how big is the tantalum market in Rwanda?
That's a very good question. In terms of what we're looking to achieve initially, we're looking to do probably a container to two containers a quarter. And that is in the first, let's say, couple quarters. What's that? That a container is approximately 25 tons. So, and tantalum, just so you know, is trading in right now at about $190 per kilogram. $190,000 per ton.
I was going to say, per ton, what are you wasting your time doing that?
Major waste of time. The price that low. But factor 1,000, you know, I'm good with numbers.
Okay. So you're hoping that will be 150 tons a year to start to get going?
We should be doing a container, at least a container a month after 6 to 9 months. So... what's that? We're talking there,
300, yeah. 300 tons a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. I was just on thinking about Rwanda, because obviously it's had a bad rap in the past. Obviously since the end of 94, I think that there's made significant progress in, you know, improving its business climate. I mean, how do you find it dealing in there? I know that there's stability's there, ease of doing business has improved. I think there are investment incentives. Just give us the listeners a sort of a brief description of how it is to work with the Rwandan government and mining institute.
As easy as working in the UK, and that's no exaggeration. In terms of physically working there, infrastructure, we're talking about a country that has paved highways throughout the entire country. So access from any one point to another is not difficult. It's a very hilly country from a geographical standpoint. So you do find that as the crow flies, a 2-hour trip is more like 4.5-5-hour trip. But besides that, in terms of working, let's say establishing a company, that's a 2-day process. In terms of registering and paying taxes, that's effective. Most of that's done online. In terms of paying people, so if somebody were to come into our yard and looking to sell a couple tons, once the assay work is done, we can pretty much pay them by mobile money the same day. It's a very good system. I liken it to, I mean, I wasn't in Singapore prior to 1995, but I hear from that kind of 1990 to 95 period that Rwanda and Singapore are very similar. And it feels like that. And Kigali is just a great place to visit, and I'm looking forward to heading there tomorrow.
Brilliant.
How has the war affected Rwanda? I mean, millions of men were killed, no?
Yeah, millions of people, men, women, children. For the most part, I think the population doesn't really talk about it. And that's not from the standpoint that there's any shame or fear. It has more to do with they're very much looking forward.
Mm.
What it has impacted, because it's a really interesting question. What it has impacted is on some of what I call transgenerational knowledge. So what we find is when we go to a particular geological site, the locals know where the material is. They know where to dig. They understand, but they don't know it as well as we hear that some of the older individuals, they will tell you, okay, there's a pegmatite over here. This is a great spot to mine. Some of the younger people say, yeah, I know an uncle or grandfather told me that around here somewhere, there was something that was good to mine, but we don't know where it is anymore. Can you help us? Can you help us with some testing? So one of the things we're trying to do with these relationships is not just go and buy material, because we don't feel that's the value added that Rwanda's really looking for or we're looking for. We're also looking to assist, whether that's from an exploration standpoint or whether that's from a capital standpoint. So with a small artisanal group, we might provide them with some mining equipment, provide them with a lease that's payable in mining in work, tantalum ore. And those little things allow them to become more productive, allow them to identify the material, allow them to produce more. And so we feel that if we can apply that across the entire country with various artisanal miners, we'll get an uplift in production. We'll actually create some value. And that, as a trading entity, would be greatly appreciated. Because generally speaking, traders do not offer a lot of value. So we're trying to change that perception.
It's interesting, just punching the figures in that you said that if once you're up to one container a month, then I'm looking at using a 12% margin if you're able to upgrade the stuff. You're looking at about £6.5 million of revenue. Oh, sorry, dollars of revenue.
Yeah, that's about right.
And about half of that is to the bottom line from basically what you're saying. So that would be sort of $3.2-3.3 million.
You have to, there is a funding cost element to it as well. So that will have to, you have to deduct that out, but your gross number's correct.
Yeah, we're on the right line anyway. I mean, how long will it take you to pay back the funding cost, you think, in terms of what?
We're hoping never to pay back the funding. We're hoping to have an outstanding balance where we're constantly generating and selling and receiving margin and just constantly reinvesting that so that our notional of borrowings, which, by the way, is secured on the product and not secured by the company. So that's not a leverage risk to the company. And just want to make that clear to your listeners. It's really about having the largest balance outstanding and keeping that and making sure we then manage and protect the margins. So if we constantly have a container or two of inventory in the yard, that's the perfect situation for us. As long as we're turning that over at least monthly.
Okay. The foresight ahead is two containers a month, three containers a month, four containers a month.
Hell, we'll take it as far as we can go. What we're really modeling right now is one container a month after 6 months.
Okay. But obviously there is the ability to expand.
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely.
Okay, well, I think that's a really good roundup of the trading part, which is really the part of Ethereum, which is different than other resource plays. So I think it's best that we leave it there. And, you know, the only thing we have to ask you is, do you want to ask the question?
Yeah, I don't mind. Yeah. Being that it's a Sunday roast, we know that the food theme, what is your, I mean, obviously I know you spend time in many countries, presumably when you come to the UK, you seek out a nice pub or tavern to have a Sunday roast. What is your favorite Sunday roast, Charles?
You're asking an American about Sunday roast? I do not feel qualified.
Come on. Yeah, but you are. Surely you are, because you don't have it often. And when you do, you know, it's an experience.
Yeah, I like the Thatch Tavern in Ascot, to be quite honest.
What do you have? Would you go for a traditional, beef?
I'd go for the lamb.
Nice.
Yeah, with the mint sauce. Has to have the mint sauce.
Sensible knowledge, I tell you. Lamb is a good choice.
Lovely.
You can have beef any day of the week, but lamb on a Sunday, that's what you have to.
Yeah. You guys are making me hungry now.
Exactly. So obviously, we'll look forward to welcoming you back on in the future. And that's just covering one small, you know, not we've hardly scratched the surface. Obviously, we can go over the Moroccan assets and talk the recent Jebelet S project. Obviously, the there's a release this week with the high grade copper results, but we can save that one to do properly next time.
Yeah, and I can tell you the geologists are super excited because it is literally 40 kilometers outside of Marrakesh. So that everyone wants to go and visit.
Sure.
That's right. I've been to Marrakesh 3 times, but I'm happy to visit again if you'd like us to come.
Wonderful. We'll have to do something for our supporters and shareholders. Thank you.
Get some sheep heads in the market in Marrakesh.
Thanks again, Charles.
Yeah, thank you.
So aside from the fact that we had a pretty rocky start to the week with the aforementioned the banking crisis in the US, what has piqued your interest this week? We've had BSF, didn't we? We had the a good rise in that share price on the back of the application, or the intention to make an application for the OTCQB. What are your thoughts on that one, the way it's moving now?
Yeah, it's good. Still only worth £17 million. So, I mean, the reality of the situation is it's still vastly undervalued. They had the AGM this week. Again, I think they reiterated Jeff has been monitoring 200 companies that are all in this space. And there are some who are severely overvalued. And he thinks that this one is severely undervalued. Now, obviously, he would say that as he is one of the directors. But I think he's right. For the technology they've got, and the IPs they've got and the city mix, I think it's severely undervalued already. But it's gone into the 20s now. Going to finish, I think, 21p on Friday. And yeah, but as I say, £17 million when there's quite a few of these businesses valued well in excess of $100-200 million.
Yeah.
And don't have as much going for it as BSF. So yeah, it's interesting.
The other one was Greatland Gold this week raised the possibility of a resource upgrade at the Havieron Gold joint venture. The Havieron exploration update confirmed the presence of gold mineralization outside of the current resource. Evaluation of the project continues, so that looked very promising this week. Anything else on the list?
We got Chill Brands came out on, what day was it? Thursday, and they'd raised $560 million. That was $560 million, I wish. £560,000, which was the ceiling for them before they roll over another year because they're on the main market, don't forget. So that was, I think, 16 million shares at 3.5p. So it was a discount of 12%, but it seems to have bounced straight back to where it was. It finished on Friday at 4.1, I think it was. So I think it's great. I mean, effectively, we've got an institution on board with 6% shareholding. And a very, very long runway now to get going with the vapes. And now we could be really looking at an explosion of sales in vapes. And as Callum said, really, this company now is about two things. It's about vapes and it's about chill.com and getting as many products onboarded so that they can make an income from other people's sales. And those two things together are going to be not unlimited, but it's pretty exciting how fast those could grow. I mean, how many vapes do you think could be sold in this sector where there's no nicotine, no harm really to anybody? It's just basically a flavor.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly looks a lot better from a share perspective. And as you say, the market's there, isn't it, for these vapes?
Yeah, and there's been obviously a lot of controversy the other side of the too much nicotine and, you know, young people getting involved in the vapes that they shouldn't be getting involved in. But these vapes are not going to have that same issue, and people will still be able to do it. Look cool, taste something. Doesn't mean you won't be addicted to the actual physical act of doing it, I think, because I think this is the issue, isn't it? You may well be sort of wanting the physical act of the vape, but not actually addicted to the chemicals in it. And there aren't really chemicals. I was asking Callum about it. It's like a type of very, very atomized thin vegetable oil that then has a flavoring in it. So food standard stuff, and then shouldn't really have any impact on your body. You know, it's just like, you know, having a portion of something that's fried, if you like. So yeah, was there anything else that we missed there?
There was a raise, wasn't there? Predator did a raise it was conditionally placed 15.5 million shares and 20.86 million existing shares transferred by a director by Paul Griffith to raise 2 million before expenses. That was at 5.5p, and I think it bounced back to around the 6 range. Obviously, that's going to help fund the operations focused in Morocco, MOU3. So that one looked quite promising. They managed to turn that around pretty quickly from what I can gather.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we'd spoken to Paul, and he was, even on the podcasts, he'd basically said he wanted to drill another hole, but he may not have the cash. But now he's got the cash. So we've got MOU1, which has been investigated again. MOU2, which has the mud or the slime issue, which hopefully is going to be resolved in the next period of time. And now they're going to have MOU3, which he will drill to 1,500 meters. So now you've got three opportunities for them to hit the jackpot, if you like, hit the gas. Pretty sure the gas is there, but it's a case of, you know, can they drill this well to make it work? If it works, sky's the limit, really, I think. And I think that's why you see Paul loaning those shares and not wanting to increase the share count even more, you know, because I think when they get more shares in the next time around, he will be repaid those shares probably.
Yeah, that's so, a real vote of confidence, wasn't it, by doing what he did, I guess.
Yeah, it's him saying, you know, I don't want this to be diluted any more than it actually absolutely has to. And I'm going to give you some of my shares in the meantime, and I'll get them back at a later date. Mm. So, yeah, it's, I think the probabilities are increasing all the time. I think that this is going to come good, but we will see in time.
There's another one that moved. I think he was the top mover of the week, bit of a slow creeper, was Verditech. They announced a three-year deal with a Swedish building products and roofing systems company, Lindab. There's no minimum sale amount or even any guarantee that there will be any sales. However, Verditech has previously supplied €100,000 worth of their solar panels as part of a testing phase. Lindab have exclusively over the distribution of Verditech panels across Nordic countries and Eastern Europe. So they were up about 90% on the week. Well, one worth keeping on there. So market cap's about £3 million. Pounds, share price of 0.85 pence. So have a look. But anything else on there? I think we've pretty much done that, haven't we? We've done the list.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously been wobbles this week. We've had copper come down in value. We've had gold come down in value a little bit. We've had the dollar increase.
FTSE come down in value a bit.
Yeah, well, if you talk about the FTSE's lost 4 or 5% this week, hasn't it? Which is has not been good at all. All on wobbles and shakes, if you like, not on fundamentals, if you like. The dollar got stronger, which like is bizarre, considering it's in America that they're having the problems with the banks. And those started to come back down again towards the end of the week. So, yeah, we will see. I think we're going to have a correction in the US dollar. That's my prediction. I know I've been saying it.
And we haven't even touched on Credit Suisse. I mean, we could probably talk about that for hours. But it just looks a little bit messy. I mean, if you look at some of the things that they've, you know, drug dealers laundering money to become embroiled in major corruption cases in Africa, that one does not look good out there. And they lost about a quarter of their value on Wednesday, didn't they? So not looking good for Credit Suisse. Anyway, on that note, I think we should wrap things up. We've had a very, we've had a double header this week, and it's been a busy show. Yeah. So I think we'll.
Yeah, and we hope you enjoy it. One of the things we will say, and we never normally say this, is, you know, smash that like or whatever, but actually we now do have a YouTube channel which has all of these podcasts on as well. So if you want to go and check us out over there on the YouTube channel, The Sunday Roast, join and like or subscribe and like.
So hit the like button, hit the subscribe, and if you make sure you select the bell icon so you get notified when there's a new podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no adverts or anything. We're not trying to make any money out of YouTube. It's just giving you another option to listen. And the whole back catalogue is there as well. It's also on Audio Boom as well. If you ever want to, you know, you're looking at one of the stocks and you want to go back and have a look at, or listen to what's been said in the past, you know, please go back. Audio Boom has them all. And now YouTube has them all as well. And we'll also... released on YouTube at the same time as released on here or on Audio Boom. So yeah. So again, we thank you for all your time and your listening to us. For sure, we don't always get it right, but we're trying our best to give you as much information as we can to help you make an educated decision.
Have a good rest of the Sunday, and then we'll catch up soon. Catch up next week.
Goodbye. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.